The Reality Equation, a narration by John Rector. Two people stand in the same room and watch the same thing happen. Afterward, one of them is elated. The other is devastated. Nothing about the event differed. The event is not in dispute. If you brought in a camera, it would settle nothing, because the camera would agree with both of them. What differed is not what happened. What differed is what each of them brought to it. We usually explain this away. We say they interpreted it differently. We say they had different perspectives. And then we quietly file interpretation under soft things, downstream things, the stuff that happens to people after reality is finished being real. I want to make the opposite claim, and I want to make it literally rather than poetically. Reality is not the event. Reality is the event divided by what you expected of it. That's the whole thing. Reality equals actual over expectation. What arrived divided by the structure it landed in. Not the world, and not the opinion, but the relation between them, which is the only thing any of us has ever actually lived inside. It's easy to write and hard to hold, and it's hard for a specific reason. The word reality has been doing two incompatible jobs in ordinary speech for a very long time. Sometimes we use it to mean the immovable record of what occurred. Face reality. The reality of the situation, and sometimes we use it to mean the felt texture of a life. His reality is very different from mine. Those aren't sloppy variants of one idea. One of them names the top of the fraction, the other names the answer, and collapsing them together is the single most expensive mistake in this entire subject. So watch what changes the moment you write a division instead of an identity. The same event can produce any reality at all. A raise of 4% divided by an expectation of 2 is a good day. The same 4% divided by an expectation of 10 is a catastrophe. Nothing about the money moved. The money is the numerator. The day is the answer. Reality can change without the world changing. This is the fact that makes the whole idea worth its trouble. Someone can tell you a single sentence about something that happened 10 years ago, and your present experience can invert instantly, while the past sits there untouched. Denominators are revisable, numerators are not, and reality has a resting point. When what arrived equals what was expected, the answer is 1. The world came in exactly as the structure predicted it. That isn't bliss and it isn't despair. It's the flat, unmarked condition in which nothing needs to be registered at all. Almost all of experience is spent very close to it, which is precisely why almost all of experience is invisible to us. Now, why a division? Why not just subtraction? Why not the gap between what you got and what you wanted? Because experience is scale relative, and difference isn't. A $1 shortfall on a $1 expectation is total failure. A $1 shortfall on a $1 million expectation is a rounding error. Subtraction reports the same number for both of those. Division reports 0, and basically 1, which is exactly what the person in each situation would report. Division also has the right resting point. 0 is where a difference goes quiet, 1 is where a ratio goes quiet, and 1 is the number that leaves things unchanged when you multiply by it. Expectations stack, ratios chain cleanly, differences don't. Now here's where it gets interesting, because the denominator is not one thing. It has two parts, and they are made of different stuff. Think about someone waiting on a medical result. Ask them what they expect. They'll give you a forecast, probably fine, 90%. Now ask them what they want, what they fear, what they are pointed at. They'll give you something else entirely, and it will not be a number on the same axis. It has no magnitude on the forecast axis at all. It isn't a competing prediction. It's a direction. That second thing is not noise on the first. It doesn't average with the forecast, and it doesn't correct it. Two people with identical, accurate, well-calibrated forecasts can have completely different experiences of the very same result, and the difference is not in what they predicted. So the denominator has a predictive part and a directional part. How much, and from what angle, and they are perpendicular to each other. No amount of forecasting accuracy converts into orientation, and no amount of orientation improves a forecast, which means expectation isn't just a size, it's a size held from a stance. And that has a consequence that I think is the most underrated fact about human experience. If expectation has an angle, then so does surprise. Surprise isn't only how far off you were. It's also which direction the correction came from. Anyone who has been blindsided by something they had also predicted knows these are two different experiences. People say it all the time. I never saw it coming. It came out of nowhere, and often they're said by people whose forecast was perfectly fine. They weren't wrong about the odds. They were hit from an axis they weren't facing. Let's talk about the part of you that makes the forecast, because it's the most consequential machine in your life, and you've never met it. Every entity has a predictive structure that continuously estimates what's about to happen. In a person, it's subconscious, fast, involuntary, and it never rests. It is running right now while you listen. It's predicting the next word, the next syllable, the weight of whatever's in your hand, the pressure of the chair, the sound the room will make in a second. Almost none of that reaches you. And that is the entire point. Prediction that succeeds is silent. Four things about this machine matter. It's always on. There is no state you can be in where nothing is being predicted. Even boredom is a prediction being confirmed. It hands you one number. Whatever internal richness it has, and it has a great deal, what it gives the equation is a single guess. It's conservative. It does not update on one signal. It is trying to hold a low, stable error, so it treats a single deviation as noise until repeated arrivals confirm a new pattern. This is why one good day doesn't change a life, and why, honestly, one betrayal often doesn't either. And it is trained by action and consequence, not by talk. Telling yourself something is not an input it respects. This is the least popular sentence in the whole framework, and it's the one with the most evidence behind it, which gives us a real definition of learning. Learning is not the acquisition of statements. Learning is the reshaping of the thing that guesses through repeated contact with what actually arrives. And that definition explains something otherwise baffling. A person can know, sincerely and propositionally, that a fear is unfounded and be no less afraid. The proposition went into a different system. The machine was never reshaped because the machine is not addressable by assertion. It's addressable by repetition and consequence, which is what practice is, which is what exposure is, which is what lived experience is. Two quick things this buys you immediately. First, why good news wears off. You get the thing, your experience spikes, weeks later it's gone, and nothing about the thing has changed. The conservative machine explains that exactly. The first arrival was a genuine surprise. Then, on repeated confirmation, the machine reshapes. The new level becomes the expected level. The guess rises to meet the world. The answer goes back to one. The surprise goes to zero. The thing is still there. The experience isn't. That's not a defect. It's the machine doing the only thing it's for. It absorbs structure so that your attention can go somewhere else. But it does have a hard consequence. If reality is a quotient and denominators adapt, then a durably good life cannot come from a fixed set of circumstances. It comes either from a rising numerator, which is a treadmill, or from work on the denominator, which is the only intervention that doesn't require the world's cooperation. Second, and more useful, there are two completely different reasons to be unhappy, and they need opposite treatments. Imagine someone who is repeatedly disappointed by other people. One possibility is prediction error. Their machine is miscalibrated. It expects more reliability than the world supplies. The fix for this is exposure. Enough real arrivals, repeated, and the machine reshapes on its own, and the disappointment declines without any change of values whatsoever. The other possibility is that their machine is fine. They're predicting people accurately. What they're carrying is a lean in the directional part, a held ideal about how people ought to be, pointed somewhere the world does not support. And here's the thing, exposure does nothing for that. More accurate predictions leave that disappointment exactly where it was, which is why this kind of person often becomes cynical and no happier at all. They revise the forecast and never touch the orientation. You can tell them apart with one question. Does the disappointment keep showing up in the same shape across different people and different situations? Prediction errors are scattered. A repeating shape is not a fact about the world. It's a fact about you. And almost everything sold as personal transformation is one of those two operations confused for the other. People try to fix a lean by gathering more evidence. People try to fix a miscalibrated machine by deciding to feel differently, Both fail, both feel like enormous effort, and the equation predicts the failure of each. All right, that's the spine. Now I want to take you somewhere the first version of this idea never went. Because there's something I skipped, and once you see it, you can't unsee it. The machine hands you one number, a guess. But a guess is a resolution, and you cannot resolve alternatives you don't have. So what was there before the guess? There's a whole distribution, a cloud of possibility that the machine is holding, right up until the instant it collapses into the one number that goes into the equation. The equation gets the guess, the machine keeps the cloud. And I've come to think that the cloud is where consciousness lives. Now I want to be careful here, because this is the place where people overclaim, and I'm not going to. We cannot know what anything feels from the inside. We don't know what the sun feels, what a bird feels, what a rock feels, or what the person across from you feels. That privacy is real, and no equation dissolves it. I'm not solving the hard problem. I'm not going to pretend to. What I'm offering is an estimate from the outside. One question, asked about anything. What is the shape of the cloud that this thing holds before it guesses? And there are two things you can measure about a cloud, and they're independent. The first is how wide it is, how much unresolved possibility is being held, call it spread. The second is how organized that width is, whether it's a smear or whether it's made of distinct, stable, separable alternatives, call it coherence. And the claim is that apparent consciousness is those two things multiplied together. Which means there are two completely different ways to be unconscious, and they are opposites. You can be collapsed, almost no spread, nothing to choose among. That's a rock. That's deep anesthesia. Or you can be incoherent, enormous spread, but no organization. Too much unresolved signal and no stable way to turn it into anything. That's static. That's delirium. Here's the metaphor that makes it exact, and it isn't really a metaphor because the mathematics is literally the mathematics of sound. A pure tone is one component, perfectly organized, no spread, that's collapse. White noise is 1,000 components with random timing. Enormous spread, no organization, that's incoherence. Music is many components, held together in organized relation, wide and structured at the same time. Consciousness is music. It's not certainty and it's not chaos. It's organized uncertainty. It's the felt geometry of prediction. And this gives choice a definition that neither inflates it into metaphysics nor dissolves it into nothing. Choice is the felt resolution of a wide, coherent cloud into one guess, one action, one direction. A machine with no spread has nothing to select among. A machine with no coherence has nothing selectable. Now, there's a beautiful result hiding in this, and it took me a while to see it. You might think more spread is always more consciousness. Hold more possibility, be more awake. But that's obviously wrong. There is such a thing as too much. And here's why. Coherence isn't free. Every machine has some finite capacity to organize what it's holding. Push spread past that capacity and coherence starts to fail. So the curve rises, peaks, and comes back down. And when you work out where the peak is, you get something striking. Consciousness is maximized when spread is pushed right up to the edge of the machine's ability to keep it coherent. Below the edge is collapse. Tone. Above the edge is noise. Right at the edge is music. That's an edge of chaos statement. It says the most awake condition available to any system is the one where it's holding just barely more than it can organize, and organizing it anyway. And it explains something that would otherwise be a paradox. If the machine is trying to minimize error, shouldn't it narrow its cloud all the way down toward certainty, and therefore toward collapse? No. Because in a rich, changing world, a collapsed model is catastrophically wrong the instant the world moves. The error-minimizing model isn't the narrowest one. It's the one whose organized width matches the actual structured complexity of the environment. Too narrow, and you get blindsided. Too wide and unstructured, and you can't act at all. Which gives you a sentence I keep coming back to. Consciousness is the internalized shape of the world's own structured uncertainty. Two more things about this before I move on, because they're the ones with teeth. The first is that consciousness has to be indexed to something. You have to say, conscious of what? The same bird can be right at the peak with respect to predator motion and completely collapsed with respect to next winter. That's not a hedge. That's how the word is actually used. A single number for a whole creature is a chosen average, not a fact. And that index turns a metaphor about business into an actual measurement. A company that sells a product has to guess. Every day it guesses demand, price, quality, competition, timing. It has no guaranteed revenue, only a forecast. So its cloud, with respect to revenue, is wide, and it has to stay sensitive, because the customer keeps arriving and can say yes, no, leave, or switch. A company that collects rent does not want to guess. It converts open uncertainty into lease, title, debt, toll, license, lock-in, enforceable claim. It doesn't want to ask each morning, will they buy? It wants to say they owe, which means it has narrowed its cloud, reduced spread, reduced sensitivity, replaced guess with claim. So when a product company becomes a rent collector, it isn't merely changing its business model. It's changing the shape of a prediction machine. And every surprise living in the part it stopped tracking is a surprise it can no longer feel. The second thing is the one that surprises people most. Surprise is not the measure of consciousness. A wide, well-organized machine may predict beautifully. Its expectations may be met constantly. Its surprise may be almost zero. And it can be enormously conscious anyway, because consciousness is read from the machine that made the guess, not from the correction that followed it. The master craftsman who is almost never surprised in her domain is not less awake than the novice who is startled by everything. Her landscape of possible surprises is more finely carved, not flatter. She's holding more, better organized, and being right about it. Okay, we've followed the denominator all the way down. Now let's follow the numerator forward. Something arrives. Then what? Take a black box, feed a complex sound wave into it, ask one question. How much of that wave can the box pull apart into coherent pieces? If it passes through untouched, the box has understood nothing. It preserved the signal perfectly and resolved none of it. If it pulls out one clean tone and leaves the rest as mush, it's done a little. 12 pieces, more, 32, more still. That's intelligence. Not fidelity, not storage, not transmission. Resolution. A lawyer takes a case and pulls out jurisdiction, standing, negligence, causation, intent, admissibility, precedent, liability, damages, procedural posture, settlement leverage. A physician takes patient feels bad and pulls out history, vitals, labs, medications, risk factors, a differential. A musician takes a song and pulls out rhythm, key, harmony, melody, bass line, modulation, phrase, tension, release, timbre. The novice receives one blob. The expert receives 30 pieces. And there's a rule that keeps this honest, because otherwise you could just chop things up into meaningless fragments and call it genius. A piece only counts if it pays for itself. It has to actually shorten your description of the world by more than it costs to carry it. It has to hold together. It has to survive a little jitter. And it has to keep working on cases you haven't seen yet. Fragments don't pay. Invented structure doesn't pay. Structure that's really there does. Now here's the part I find genuinely moving. Whatever a system pulls out, it eventually absorbs. And absorbed things go quiet. Your subconscious is the enormous absorbed layer you were born with. Breathing, balance, digestion, the whole business of standing upright. A gigantic decomposition of the world, running at zero attention cost. You do not attend to the stairs you did once. Expertise is the same thing, acquired. The lawyer's 30 components cost her nothing to carry. Jurisdiction and standing get checked without any felt effort at all. And whatever a system cannot pull out stays behind. Call that the remainder. Three things about the remainder, and all three are easy to get wrong. It's relative to the system. What's noise to one is structure to a finer one. The novice's remainder contains the lawyer's components. Noise is a verdict, and no finite system has the right to it. It's not the unimportant part. Nothing says the pieces matter more than what's left over. In law, the case turns on the unnamed thing. In medicine, on the anomaly outside the differential. In music, the entire artistic payload can live in timing deviations that no notation can capture. And more intelligence does not mean less song. Absorbing more does not silence the world. It refines what you're listening to. The novice lawyer dances to "This case feels bad." The expert dances to a hesitation in a deposition answer. Same case, different music, because different remainders. We dance to the remainder. Which brings us to attention, and I think this is the definition that makes the modern world legible. Attention is not a spotlight. It's not a budget. It's not a faculty you have. Attention is accumulated surprise. Prediction runs constantly. Almost all of it succeeds and produces nothing at all. Where it fails, surprise accumulates. And attention is the conscious record of what reality could not make disappear. Three things follow immediately. Attention is a remainder, not a resource. It's what's left when prediction hasn't finished its work, which is why it can't be manufactured, only freed, and why every attempt to capture more of it is a fight over a byproduct rather than a supply. Attention is where things get settled. Surprise piles up until something resolves it. Attention is where a discrepancy stops being a signal and becomes a judgment, a decision, an act. Nothing else in the system does that. And attention is the resource beneath every other resource. Money can be borrowed, energy can be generated, computation can be scaled, attention cannot be borrowed, and every human future has to pass through it first. Now put absorption and attention together and you get a sentence about trust that I think is exactly right. Trust is amortized attention. A system earns the right to be ignored the way a loan is retired. One uneventful payment at a time, on a schedule no demonstration can skip. Which is why trust can't be asserted or demonstrated once or purchased. The machine is conservative by construction. It changes only when repeated arrivals confirm that a new pattern is real. A perfect demo moves it not at all, and it explains the strange emotional signature of handing work over to a system. Nobody resents their own subconscious because it came before their agency. No one was present for the handover. But bureaucracies and tools and now algorithms arrive after conscious discretion. So the transfer of attention and judgment into a procedure gets experienced as a loss, even when the gain is completely real. The love-hate relationship with bureaucracy is what absorption feels like when you were there for it. Speaking of which, let me say the thing about bureaucracy because I think it's the cleanest large-scale case. A bureaucracy is a decomposition machine running on human life. Its vocabulary is laws, forms, categories, credentials, licenses, ledgers, scores, permissions, approvals, titles, claims. It takes the dense, continuous, morally loaded flow of human situations and resolves it into filed claims, granted statuses, computed scores. When it's healthy, every one of those pieces pays for itself. It lets millions of interactions get settled without fresh deliberation, and the payment is measured in attention released. Bureaucracy is civilization's synthetic subconscious. A society doesn't consciously renegotiate every property claim, every loan, every border crossing, every payroll event, every hospital intake. Those got absorbed into procedure, exactly the way breathing got absorbed into your body. And it fails in exactly the ways the framework predicts. It goes stale. The vocabulary was fit on a world that has moved. So pieces that once paid quietly stop paying, and nobody reruns the test. It goes ritual, a form that protects against nothing, an approval that screens nothing, still mandatory. And you could actually measure that. What fraction of enforced procedures would fail a current review? It fragments, multiplying categories past anything it can validate. And then the fatal one. It starts acting as though the remainder doesn't exist, as though the form is the whole person. The patient whose condition fits no intake category, the applicant whose reliability is obvious to a neighbor and invisible to a score. Which gives you the design lesson, and it's the most actionable thing in this whole framework. Healthy institutions have appeal paths. An appeal is formally a confession that the remainder is not zero, plus a mechanism for running the case through a finer system, a human judge, an exception process. So the quality of an institution isn't only how well it decomposes, it's whether its architecture knows its own remainder exists. An institution with high resolution and no appeal path is a machine that has mistaken its own limits for the boundary of the world. And it will fail exactly where its categories run out, which is to say, on the cases that matter most. Now, artificial intelligence, and I want to be precise here rather than dramatic, I think intelligence and consciousness are two different measurements, of two different objects, at two different moments. Consciousness reads the cloud a system holds before it guesses. Intelligence reads how finely a system resolves what arrives. Neither one is definable from the other, and they come apart in both directions. A signal processing chip that decomposes sound into its complete spectrum is, relative to that task, almost perfectly intelligent. It resolves everything, and its cloud is a point. The computation is deterministic. There's nothing being held. Brilliant. And holding nothing. And a person lying in bed in vivid reverie is holding an enormous, beautifully organized cloud and decomposing exactly nothing of the legal brief sitting on the table. For all of human history, those two things traveled together, because the same evolved machinery produced both of them. Every system we ever met that could resolve a rich signal was also awake. So high intelligence implies consciousness was a completely reliable inference. Not because people were foolish, because the sample was biased. Language models are the first systems to pull those apart at scale. And so the inference fails, and it fails on cues we were built to trust. Coherence, which shows up in both theories in different roles. And fluency, which used to be expensive and is now free. I am not saying these systems feel nothing. I'm saying the inference from what they do to what they are is invalid, because it's an inference between two measurements that are simply not the same measurement. But here's the part I think is more practically urgent, and it isn't about consciousness at all. The effective intelligence of any system is its capacity to resolve, multiplied by the fidelity of what actually reaches it. And that second factor is thin right now. Very thin. A model reading a chart is not reading a patient. An agent reading a customer record is not meeting a customer. The stream arriving at these systems is prompts, retrieved chunks, files, screenshots, logs, confirmations, traces of traces. So you get a system with genuinely superb resolution operating on a representation that has quietly drifted from the thing it was supposed to represent. And the failure mode is very specific. Locally impeccable operations, globally unmoored. Competence that is real and misplaced. Low capacity looks like incompetence and you catch it. Low fidelity looks like confident competence about the wrong world, and you don't. Because every internal check, the system can run lives on the same corrupted trace, which tells you where the work is, not in making the decomposer smarter, in enriching what arrives, sensing, verification against ground truth, memory that accumulates instead of resetting, consequence feedback that closes the loop, and appeal paths imported straight from the bureaucracy. Because an agent is safe in exactly the proportion that its architecture admits its remainder is not zero. And here's the twist I didn't expect when I started. Bureaucracy has already pre-chewed the world into stable symbolic chunks with explicit vocabularies and slow drift. Which is to say, in a bureaucracy, the trace approaches the territory. The form is the legally operative object. The docket entry is the procedural fact. So bureaucracy does not make artificial intelligence more like life. Bureaucracy makes life more like the data these systems were trained on. That's why they arrive there first. Not because they're human-like in that domain, but because that domain was already decomposed into the kind of world a checkpoint can faithfully receive. Let me close with the economics and then with the thing underneath all of it. Artificial intelligence becomes genuinely valuable at the moment it stops asking to be noticed. The real productivity metric is not how much a machine can do, it's how little attention it requires while doing it. Every mature technology has made that trip. Electricity, plumbing, refrigeration, the payment network, they earned the right to be ignored. Which means the pressure on conventional software is not really a pressure on features. Seats and dashboards and interfaces are all instruments for capturing attention. A system that absorbs the work and hands the attention back has beaten them on the one axis the incumbent can't concede, because the incumbent's revenue is denominated in exactly the thing the customer wants returned. But absorption has costs, and two of them are worth naming. The first is the apprenticeship gap. Absorption eats routine work. And routine work is what quietly trained every expert who ever lived. Every piece a novice absorbs got absorbed by doing the boring version of the task many, many times. Remove the boring version, and the vocabulary never gets built, and the ceiling comes down for a whole generation. Closing that gap means deliberately designing surprise back into the training, which is what deliberate practice has always been. Putting absorbed things back into the attended stream on purpose, in order to sharpen them. The second is the one nobody plans for. Absorption does not destroy surprise, it defers it. A system safely ignored for years hasn't eliminated the possibility of an anomaly. It has concentrated the whole of that possibility into a single, unscheduled future event. So anything successfully ignored stays solvent only if somebody holds a reserve. Rehearsed attention, kept ready for the day the ignored system hands the problem back. Pilots who haven't flown by hand in years, operators who have never seen the failure mode, institutions with no living memory of the last crisis. Intelligence cannot make the world unsurprising. It can only make the surprise residual, and the residual arrives on its own schedule, not yours. Which leaves one question, and it's the one I actually care about most. Why does any of this keep going? Look at what the framework predicts about a stable world. Machines learn, components get absorbed, absorbed things go quiet, the guess rises to meet the world. The answer settles at 1, the surprise settles at 0, and experience flattens into a permanent hum. That doesn't happen. Not to people, not to institutions, not to the species. Why not? Part of the answer is that the world has its own irreducible entropy, and no amount of intelligence touches it. There's always residue. Fine. But that only explains why noise persists. It doesn't explain why the residue is structured, why it rewards attention, why resolving one layer of it reliably exposes another one underneath. Part of it is that coherent spread is the optimum. Machines that survive don't collapse their clouds, because a collapsed model dies the moment the world moves. So they hold live possibility, permanently, as a condition of continuing to function. Better. Still doesn't explain why the environment keeps having more structure to match. Here's what I actually think. Ideas are endpoints. Directions in the space of what could be. They don't occur, they orient. And they get actualized only through real actualizers, in the real world, always at finite resolution. No finite thing resolves the continuum. That isn't a temporary limitation to be engineered away. It's a permanent property of being finite, which means every actualization is partial. Every made thing is a projection of something unconditioned onto a maker with limits. And the difference between what was pointed at and what actually got made is, precisely, a remainder. That remainder isn't noise, it's the structured gap between the aim and the artifact. It's what the next maker resolves a little further, and what the one after that refines again, each at their own finite resolution, each leaving a finer remainder behind them. Reality persists because ideals have not yet achieved perfect actualization through real actualizers. And they can't because actualizers are finite. The gap is the engine. So when the answer isn't one, which is always, don't treat it as the world's failure to cooperate. It's the signature of an unfinished actualization, which is the only condition under which anything is still being made. 3 things, then, to carry out of this. Don't ask only what happened. Ask what it was divided by. Don't ask only what something feels. Ask what the shape of the machine is that generates its guess. And don't ask only how smart something is. Ask what it resolved, at what gain, against what trace, and what it left in the remainder. Because the remainder is where the surprise lives, and we dance to the remainder.